What's up, guys? Welcome to the Hypertrophy Cast. My name is Luis Frühlingsdorf. I'm the podcast host, and this is another English episode because today we got Dr. Eric Helms on deck, and I'm so honored to have you on here today, Eric. You're a pro natural bodybuilder, powerlifter. You have a PhD in strength and conditioning, a master's degree in sports nutrition, as well as in exercise science, and you're a coach at 3D Muscle Journey, and glad to have you on here, Eric. Thanks for taking the time. How are you doing?
Luis, I'm doing really well, and I really appreciate you having me on and accepting the fact that I cannot speak German and that I am one of those Americans who just only speaks one language. So happy to be on and happy to provide whatever kind of information I can.
Awesome. Thank you. And most people will probably know you already, but do you want to introduce yourself a little further to listeners which may not?
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate the kind of the CV introduction that you gave me, and that's a good summary of kind of where I'm at today. But I really just started out as a dude who fell in love with lifting. And due to my obsessive nature, it became my career, my intellectual pursuit in academia, my personal addiction / positive expression of self. And now, today I basically have the mission statement of trying to provide community support to drug-free lifters and the lifting community as a whole. And I do that through a lot of different pathways. So I'm a research fellow here at the Auckland University of Technology, specifically for the Sports Performance Research Institute in New Zealand, where I'm in the strength and conditioning stream. So I work with PhD and master's students who are interested in basically being muscle nerds. And then I also have the opportunity to be the chief science officer for 3DMJ, like you said, that we started a decade ago, where we provide information to drug-free bodybuilders and strength athletes. And then I've got some other pathways of doing that. I've got my books, The Pyramids. I'm a reviewer for MASS, which I co-founded with Greg Knuckles and Dr. Trexler and Dr. Zerdos. And I'm a multi-sport strength and physique athlete who's mediocre at all of them. So it's good times.
2019 has been a really crazy year for you because you competed in natural bodybuilding, powerlifting, weightlifting, and strongman in the same year. And I think, that's completely ridiculous. How has this
Almost all of those. So I did my first two strongman shows, and I did do my whole bodybuilding season. But I actually haven't been on weightlifting or powerlifting platform since 2014 and 2016. However, 2020 is the plan to get the trifecta in. I won't be doing bodybuilding again next year, but I will do all three of the strength sports. So I think the funnest part of that is figuring out the way to periodize and program and train myself for doing that. That's just as much of fun as the challenge of the physicality.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you have to juggle all these variables, and you can't really train completely specific to just one goal. And I think that's kind of interesting. And what are your plans for 2020? I mean, you mentioned competing in powerlifting and weightlifting. So I got that wrong. I thought that already happened in 2019, but you're gonna.
Well, I mean, it's hard to keep track because, like you said, I probably do too much. So much. I did a bodybuilding show in April. I did then two in July and then one in August. I finished my season at that August and then at August show, and then 1 month later, I did my first strongman competition, which was a truck pull and max stones to 1.2 meter height, and that went really well. That was my first foray into strongman. And I started, I've done on and off training here and there, but I specifically trained for that comp for a month, so like specific implements. And then a month after that, I did a static event. So I did three attempts on max log and then max strongman deadlifts. That's conventional hitching allowed with straps on a deadlift bar. The goal for 2020 is to do a full medley event, so four or five events, and not zero anything is basically the goal, and then at some point get on the weightlifting and the powerlifting platform again. So to do all three sports and not get hurt is the goal for 2020. And basically, like you said, I can't be too specific in general. But when I get close to a specific competition, I think of it, the way I describe it is that it's like when you're cooking and you've got multiple things at the same time, you put something on the back burner so that it doesn't, you know, get cold. You don't want it to actually regress at all. You need to keep it warm and cooked and at the right temperature. And essentially, anytime I'm like 2 months or so out from a specific competition, all of a sudden the other two go to the back burner and that one comes forward. So a lot of that is going to be basically what periodization is all about. And if you think about it, this isn't that much different than what, say, a team sport athlete has to do, where they've got to have aerobic, anaerobic strength and skill conditioning all at the same time. So essentially, the competition schedule is going to dictate when I go from kind of that baseline program where I'm doing a little bit of everything to when I'm doing just enough of two and then focusing on one. And right now, probably it's going to be an April weightlifting meet and a May strongman competition. And then because I have the longest background in powerlifting and I'm out of the strength sports, I'm the least mediocre in powerlifting. So that will take me the longest time to actually improve and peak four to a peak that was hopefully higher than I was before. So that'll probably be like end of year. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think those skills are not as far as apart as most people will think. I think if you perform the powerlift or train really specific for powerlifting, you will most likely keep your hypertrophy adaptations most of the time. So yeah, I think that will work out for you really well. Don't forget the curls.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, those don't get forgot. Yeah, that's the cool thing is that essentially my accessory movements become my bodybuilding work. Mm-hmm. And so long as I'm getting in a couple of days of doing calf raises and curls and hamstring curls and lateral raises, you know, that I'm good to go. Because a lot of other things make sense or are at least indirectly helpful to a strength athlete, like rows, pull downs. I'm obviously doing overhead work and benching. So my pushing musculature is not really going to be sacrificed. I'm doing snatches, clean and jerks, squats, deadlifts. So obviously quads, glutes, hams, erectors, you know, there's very few things that I actually need to think about, oh, I got to do enough here. But at the same time, you also have to realize that the main lifts for a weightlifter or a powerlifter or the specific implement training for a strongman, they are highly fatiguing. And while they do stimulate hypertrophy, they're maybe not the best vehicles. So like if I need additional quad growth because I'm not doing enough on the main lifts, I'm not going to do another day of squatting. I'm going to do like BFR leg extensions or, you know, single leg press or something like that. Yeah.
Definitely. Cool. And I have some questions for you today. One topic I want to talk to you about is training volume. I think a really interesting topic for most hypertrophy athletes. And the thing with volume, volume is basically the total amount of work we do in the gym, often quantified as the number of hardworking sets. And currently, we know that volume and hypertrophy have that dose-response relationship. If we perform more total work in the gym, we usually tend to see more hypertrophy as long as we are recovering from that training stress, of course. And recovery is defined in the literature as a return to baseline performance. So as long as your performance is not dropping, you are, per definition, recovering. So theoretically, an athlete could use higher volumes to potentially make better adaptations, but just focusing on numbers in the gym is just one side of the coin, of course. So what else should an athlete be concerned of when adding training volume to their program?
Yeah, I think one of the issues here is that the definition of recovery being that the performance recovery is returned to baseline, that is recovery by definition. But we also use the term recovery in many colloquial ways, like I feel good, I feel fresh, I don't have injuries, I feel quote unquote recovered. So I think people talk about subjective recovery. And then they also talk about physical performance recovery, and they don't overlap completely. I'll give you a specific example that when you look at what it takes to create the symptoms of overtraining syndrome or non-functional overreaching, one of the characteristics that drops off last is actually strength. Maximal force production goes down kind of last. And you might see some power reductions before that. And you also will see that your ability to perform volume, so your quote unquote multi-set strength endurance compared to your maximal force production, they recover at different rates. So while as a general kind of principle saying, hey, when your recovery's back, you're at baseline. The problem is that how are you measuring that? And it may be that you're still at a greater risk of injury. You may still have immune suppression. Your sleep might still be disrupted. You might be experiencing subjective fatigue and a loss of motivation. And it is even possible that you could be over the hump, quote unquote, of how much is an appropriate amount of workload to produce maximum adaptations in hypertrophy, or even be stagnating while still maintaining strength. So I think the problem with the model where you do as much as you can, so long as you aren't regressing in performance, whether that's across multiple mesocycles or multiple microcycles, where you're increasing volume over time, is that it doesn't pay heed to that fact, that there are multiple components of recovery. So I think that's something that we need to take into consideration. So I would say we need probably a more holistic definition of recovery until we can get to the point where we can actually measure, like, quote unquote, hypertrophy recovery, you know, like mm-hmm. the relevant pieces that go into that. And that's why I'm not a huge fan of just doing as much as you can until you are plateaued in your performance, deloading then and then restarting it. And even folks who do use that model, for example, to give a lot of credit to Dr. Mike Isretel, back in, three, four, 5 years ago, I can't remember when we had the volume roundtable debate that Jeff Nippert hosted. Myself, Greg Knuckles, and he were on that, and we discussed this relationship, and he changed his position, and he said, you know, instead of trying to train an MRV all the time, we should cycle from the minimum effective volume up to perhaps somewhere around where we think MRV is. And I think that gets around a lot of those logistic problems. You know, you aren't hanging around this state teetering off the edge where you have to actually see a drop in maximal force production, which is a lot. You have to really beat yourself up to see that's consistently happen, and it's probably too much and probably counterproductive. To now, his model uses more of a gradual building approach, because we don't really know if you need to do the most possible amount of work to. In fact, I would say there's an argument against that there's this bell curve of how much volume is appropriate. The quote, the theoretical inverted U hypothesis to volume, and we can talk about that in a second. But essentially, as you add sets, like you were saying, you see a linear but not proportionate, so meaning a diminishing returns amount of increase in hypertrophy as you increase volume. And eventually, as you're adding volume, you're not seeing any increase in the rate of hypertrophy. Then you start to see a decrease, but still hypertrophy occurring. And eventually, all the way down on the other side of that slope is where you're doing more sets and you're not progressing or regressing. And that's a crap ton of volume. So being on that side of the bell curve is probably something that is has more risks than reward, and actually objectively is slowing you down. So you wouldn't want to be there except for maybe some hypothetical overreaching, which we don't really know works for hypertrophy. So it would want to be temporary, since we have no data on overreaching for the goal of hypertrophy. We have some limited hints that perhaps there is supercompensation, like in strange scenarios, like if you throw BFR front squats at powerlifters, there's a delayed response. But a delayed response is not necessarily the same thing as supercompensation. So that was a very long answer to your question, but I'm sure it opened up more doors for us to go down.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to pick up the point where, you kind of told us about the subjective measures to kind of gauge our fatigue levels and our recovery. And we also have our numbers, our kind of objective measures, our training performance. What are potential downsides when focusing too much on one side of the spectrum? So just focusing on feelings. If I feel more tired or less motivated, instantly deload. And on the other side, keeping up, adding volume. If my numbers are not going down. So where should an athlete be in that kind of spectrum?
Yeah, subjectivity is a funny thing, man. So for someone who is very emotionally attached to their training, a novice, not very self-aware, subjectivity becomes a potential barrier and something that can make you make poor decisions. However, if you take an experienced athlete who is pretty good at being objective or has the guiding eye of a coach, subjectivity probably becomes one of your greatest tools for success. We have a love for objectivity in science because it's the cornerstone of empiricism, right? The ability to observe things and know that two things are connected requires us to have objective data that's both valid and reliable. And the problem, though, is that sometimes we will cling to a measure that is objective, but is not actually an effective surrogate for what we actually want to measure, because it is objective without even scientific data to suggest, ironically, that it is better than something subjective. So there was a systematic review that came out a couple years ago, right towards the end of my PhD, where they compared a bunch of different measures for sports performance. And the way they defined sports performance was they looked at, does it have a relationship to the total work performed or performance, the actual athletic task itself. And they compared measures of muscle damage. They compared heart rate measures. They compared hormonal markers. And then they also looked at validated questionnaires that kind of asked holistic questions about recovery, and they'd give you a score. And the important part is validated here, meaning that they've done multiple times and the questions have been written in a way that people answer them in a similar way in a repeated fashion. And hands down, the strongest indicator of the actual status of someone and what correlated the most with either workload or performance metrics was these subjective questionnaires. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. We don't have this cybernetic AI, you know, scanning system that can tell you every aspect about your physiology. But we do have millions of years of evolution to where if you can be as objective as possible when assessing yourself subjectively, you're able to encompass multiple domains of recovery and give someone an accurate picture. And that's why something like RPE has been around since 1950 and is a really useful tool. And I don't just mean necessarily repetitions and reserve-based RPE, rating of perceived exertion, more globally looking at your recovery and things like the perceived recovery status. So that's the potential benefit, and with the emphasis on potential, because that's very different than just going, how do I feel? You know, so if, for example, when I write training programs, or if you were to read my books, and there's a assessment tool to help you gauge when you need a deload, and at the end of every mesocycle, there's a checklist that I propose, and they're based on the symptoms of overtraining, overreaching that tend to transcend kind of all factors. So, for example, disturbed sleep. Is your sleep worse than normal? I ask, and it's a simple yes or no, so 0 or 1 binary answer. And we know that in overtraining syndrome, having worse sleep is both a cause and a symptom of being overraged or in a state of overtraining. And then do you have, are your joints achier or worse than normal? Do you have more pain than normal? Because you know, pain can be inhibitory to strength and performance. And it's also a potential indication that you're messed up, you're inflamed. It correlates with a lot of things that might be useful. Too much delayed onset muscle soreness could be part of that. And then are you motivated about your training? That's a huge thing you see, especially in athletes who are like bodybuilders and powerlifters who've self-selected the sport outside of school, outside of university, outside of professional sport. You know, typically we love our training. And if we don't, that tells us something. So that question, along with a few others, and then I basically go, right, if you've answered yes to 2 or more, it's time to take a deload. Then I go, hey, and if you've gone 3 mesocycles without taking a deload, just take one just in case, because you're probably lying on these questionnaires anyway, or your training's not hard enough, you know? So I think there is a ton of value in having this subjective awareness that when done right is better than most objective markers we have available in sports science. And again, as a note, the only one that's available to someone who's hanging out, you know, listening to this podcast, if you're not working in a sports science facility, is probably going to be performance. And that's a close second to subjectivity. So you want to look at both. I think a really good way to assess the utility of performance is to let you know whether or not progressive overload has occurred. Another issue with the way people envision volume is they go, right, so volume is one of the key components that drives hypertrophy, because it's how we quantify the amount of progressive tension overload that you put on the muscles. And if that's the root cause, then how much we turn that volume dial up and down, quite literally, should dictate the adaptation, like you said. However, how do we know if we've actually adapted, right? So in someone who has relatively stable motor patterns, they're a well-trained lifter, and they've been following this thing for multiple mesocycles. One of the many things that contributes to strength is cross-sectional area or muscle size. And it is it's a stronger relationship the more well-trained you are, presumably because you've made the majority of your neuromuscular adaptations, right? So that means if your ability to, especially on something like a machine or a single joint movement, where there's less of a skill component, like if you just cycled back squats in and you progress for 3 weeks, that doesn't really tell us much. But if your leg extension on the same machine in the same gym you've been at for 3 years is going up, you know, like what's going on there except for some increased force production, probably at the local muscular level. So anyway, if you are seeing your ability to handle loads go up, that probably indicates that there is something going on that indicates you are adapting well to your training. You're producing the adaptation you want. And it is therefore the outcome of progressive overload. People get caught up on progressive. They think, oh, I've got to add sets week to week to week, or I've got to add load, or I've got to add reps. But you don't know if you're starting far past what you need to create that adaptation or not. So that's why I tend to favor a model where you start reasonably in the realm based on what we know from the scientific data and your prior training history in an appropriate amount of volume. Then we see, are you adapting? And then if you're getting stronger, great. We know that was adequate. And probably if in a trained lifter with an appropriate amount of volume, as close to optimal as we can know we can be. So therefore, we make modifications when performance is no longer occurring, so long as you are recovered. Because the performance tells us that overload has occurred, we have adapted, and that subjective recovery covers our basis so that we're not getting too focused on recovery. And that's kind of the model that I use to dictate when should we increase volume. And it's typically one of the last things on the checklist.
Mm-hmm. Great answer. I think you mentioned some really great points. And I want to talk with you a little bit more about the subjective measures, because for me, for example, my desire to train is initially, most of the times, not really high. Before I get to the gym, it's not like I'm completely excited to crash the weights. I know I have some heavy RDLs on the plan. So, I'm not really too excited. But when I get to the gym, I mean, after I perform my first working set, everything is good and training is fun. But in that case, yet my desire to train might not be the best metric to track for myself to gauge my fatigue, because it's in that sense always pretty low. And what I do is, for example, with clients, I track changes in those subjective measures. So I let them track subjective energy levels on a scale from 1 to 5, most likely every day. And if I see changes in the average from week to week, that gives me usually a really good information about their fatigue levels. So yeah, what I'm kind of looking for is that that change and not like the initial value per se.
Same. Now, that's exactly what I recommend as well. So I think a key component to what I was suggesting is that are you less motivated than normal? Yes or no? Because if your normal is kind of the status of, that's fine. And if it goes from to no way, that's when we need to be aware of things. So the baseline score for everyone should be 0, right? And then a positive score is 1, just to simplify it so that someone doesn't have to figure out how to run Excel and create an average and then look and create a change score. So that's why in my book, I make things as simple as possible without losing utility. So when you look at that checklist, it says, is your motivation to train worse than normal? Whatever normal might be, because like you said, anchoring is what we're talking about. It's very important, is starting with the baseline rather than some kind of group level idea of how motivated should I be to train. You know, if you're thinking, oh man, everyone else seems to really like training, but I'm just kind of, I'm a little dragging about it, that might tell you something about, you know, you that you might need to address. But it's not, like you said, a useful metric just to say, oh, therefore I'm overtrained. It's like, well, you took 2 weeks off and you feel that way. It doesn't matter. You know, you need to look at the change exactly.
Cool. Yeah. And in one of your recent Instagram posts, you mentioned that in our community, we are often obsessed with achieving optimal results, and that we are often thinking too much on the short term, because what produces like the fastest rate of progress this week will potentially reduce the progress we can achieve in the following week. So we can't always train with what is quote unquote optimal all the time. So I think A good approach is like cycling training volume. And my question for you would be, if you're programming low volume phases with clients after a couple of consecutive hypercaloric mesocycles, and if yes, when, why, and how?
Yeah, I think that I wasn't necessarily using that post to describe how we should periodize successive mesocycles, more so asking people to assess their overall philosophy behind their training.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, my audience, I'm specifically speaking to strength athletes and physique athletes, which ideally, if you're doing this right and you're not just jumping into your first show after being lifting for 4 weeks, means that if you're progressing at all, that's pretty impressive, because you probably align better with the highest levels of training age we see in the literature, rather than the standard training age we see in the literature, which is either untrained or has trained for a year or two recreationally. And the distinction between optimal and any progress is so minuscule for well-trained athletes that it might as well not matter. And there is a much greater risk than reward for trying to get that last little, you know, millimeter of extra progress by doubling or tripling your volume. And it interacts with the psychology of what we have in this kind of more is better culture, where you'll always see the grass is greener on the other side. And if you feel like you could do more, you will likely do it. And sometimes at the cost of your own progress or your own health. And that's, of course, it doesn't apply to everyone. But in general, I think it is a very useful thing to figure out what do you need to create measurable progress. And that's probably where you should spend most of your time training. And then the times when you are not doing that, it should be for a purposeful peaking period. So for example, I'll go back to my relatively unique goals of competing in three different strength sports and not backsliding and bodybuilding at all and hopefully progressing, is that my quote unquote baseline training, or as Dan John might call it, my park bench training. Park bench because you're hanging out there sitting looking around. The bus bench is when you're actually waiting for a specific schedule. My park bench training, I have a day dedicated to Olympic lifting. I have a day dedicated to strongman. And then I have 2 days where I split up the powerlifting movements. And then I have a day that's pure bodybuilding. And I put those in a microcycle in a way that allows maximal recovery intra-week. And then I run that for 3 weeks, and then I do a deload, and then I repeat. That's kind of like my baseline. And I've set up basically the minimum effective dose for each one of those main lifts where I'm actually progressing, where I'm slowly adding weight to the bar. And because I have so many high fatigue movements and I have so many multiple muscle patterns that I'm trying to achieve while doing enough volume to grow over time slowly, that is a really good example of how this can be applied. However, once I'm like I said, I've got that April weightlifting meet sometime in February, in 8-10 weeks out, I'm going to go into a training cycle where I'm doing the most I can handle as far as weightlifting, and then I'll purposely taper, and then I will put everything else on the back burner. But that is a fixed time period on purpose, and I think the philosophy that people don't even know they're following, but they will often cling to, especially with hypertrophy, which often doesn't have distinct goals until you're dieting, is I'm always trying to be on an optimal program. I'm always trying to progress as much as possible. And I think that is a fundamentally anti-sport science way of doing things. You don't see athletes do that in any sport. And because bodybuilding kind of has this off-season goal that's amorphous, like, I don't know, I'm gonna be training for 1 to 2 years and I'll get back on stage, and I know that I can't grow that well when I'm dieting, so anyway, I'm just gonna crush it for a year and a half. I think that's great, but what ends up happening is that either injury, vacation, or loss of motivation dictates when you're going hard or when you have those maintenance phases. Yeah. And it becomes an emergent approach rather than a planned approach, which isn't necessarily bad, but then it becomes slave to your psychology. So if your psychology is such that you always overdo it, and then you only, you know, draw back when you're hurt, demotivated, depressed, or have to travel, that's problematic. This can work well for someone who's like a recreational athlete. So for example, when I was a personal trainer, I wouldn't plan deloads because my clients were only coming in 2 to 3 days per week, and they would take a vacation or not be able to make a session, and they would have a periodic recovery period such that they were relatively fresh most of the time, or by the time it mattered, before they were ever risking injury or burnout. But it's not the case with athletes. So I think it probably makes sense, like I have in my my book. The recommendations I have are to assess, when do you need a deload? And essentially, that's the way I like to do it on a microcycle base level. I have undulation built into a lot of the progression plans I often use. We might hang around a fixed number of sets and then see load and reps increase or decrease, or just add reps. And then we'll recycle that, but starting higher than the last mesocycle was. So, for example, just to give a practical example, because I know a lot of people might be thinking, okay, well, I can understand this very easily with sets. Maybe I did 10 sets, 12 sets, 14 sets, deload at 8, and then I start back at 10, and the next time I increase load. That's totally fine. That's a great example of it. Another way to do it is just to do 10 sets flat the whole time, or 12 sets flat, and then have a descend in the number of reps you're doing and an ascend in the load. So you do 3 by 12 at 100 kilos, 3 by 10 at 105, 3 by 8 at 110. And then you'd start the next mesocycle just 2.5 heavier on all three. So you'd go 102, 107, 112. And that is kind of, like I said before, it's keeping pace with the overload that you've, if you can increase strength, that means something's working. So you're probably inducing hypertrophy. And you know, since you are adding strength, that you're doing enough volume to grow. And since we know that the distance between the minimum effective dose that produces a measurable increase in performance and the maximum adaptive volume in a trained lifter are so close that we can't functionally measure the difference, that that's a great place for your park bench workout to be. And then you may have phases, for example, based on when you're going to compete as a bodybuilder. One of the things we do at 3D Muscle Journey is we'll go through a diet before the diet, somewhere 3-4 months out from when you're going to diet. We get you to a nice starting point, and then you quote unquote gain-tain. We're in a very small surplus around maintenance. And then we do a specialization cycle there because you don't have as much of a surplus. We focus on one or two muscle groups that would improve your symmetry specifically for the stage. So that phase might have less global total volume and more dedicated to a specific one. And the phase where you're actually dieting, we'd be closer to a lower volume just so you can recover. And then the phase before that, you might have where you're actually doing, you're pushing it a little more and the deloads might have to come more frequent. I think one of the ways you can assess whether or not you're pushing closer to the most you can handle or less is how frequent do those deloads come. So an interesting effect, and you can see where you have to, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul when you have multiple goals. In my case, I'm training for 3 strength sports simultaneously. I'm pretty damn ready for that deload every fourth week, even though I'm taking that kind of minimum effective dose approach to gaining strength on the big, for in my case, big 7. Because I can't do a sumo pull in strongman. I've got to do a conventional, so I've got to train that sometimes. I've got to train the big 3 in powerlifting, and guess what? I happen to be a sumo puller, so right there I've got 4 movements. Strongman, I've got to do an overhead implement and a carry implement. Now I've got 6, and then I've got the snatch and clean and jerk. So I'm actually dealing with like 8 movement patterns that are all relatively fatiguing. So doing more than just the amount that I can to produce progress, I would probably be too much for me to handle unless I cut something else out somewhere else. So I've got a relatively frequent deload pattern. Is that optimal? For my specific goal, sure. Is that optimal for a bodybuilder? No. I think you'd probably want to see in the off season deloading a little less frequent than that. And that can tell you, basically, it's the tortoise versus the hare, which is an old adage that says, hey, going really, really fast and making errors and then having to correct for them typically ends up being slower in the long run than just taking a steady, nice pace. And I think that is a decent philosophy for most bodybuilders where, hey, you could be doing more, that's great, but would it net more progress? And is the potential risk of doing a little more or getting a little more progress worth the amount of work you'd have to put in? And it sometimes is not, but it depends on the individual's psychology.
Yeah. And what's kind of too frequent of a deload, and what's maybe too long of an accumulation phase for an advanced bodybuilder?
Sure. And I'm going to be speaking in some generalities that are not going to be true in all circles. I think one thing to remember is that when you've been around for a while and you have a persona, quote unquote, online, purposeful or not, but people, when they think of Eric Helms, they think of a certain training style, they think of certain principles, they think of my books. And therefore, the people who I end up giving me feedback, who I work with or who work with 3DMJ, self-select and filter to some degree. And the So that means that sometimes our own biases get reconfirmed. Early on in 3DMJ's existence, when we weren't that well known, you know, we would get athletes and we based our observations off of just all the different types of people that came to us. But now that population narrows and people already like 3DMJ before they hire us. So when I say this is what we've observed, remember that it's in a population of people that are probably self-selecting for us to some degree. So anyway, with that caveat, based on talking to other people, what I've seen in the literature, and from working with those in the 3DMJ athlete collective, generally, if you were the most frequent deload you'd ever want to do, in my opinion, is probably every fourth week. So you have 3 weeks of overloading, one fourth week of deloading. You can set that up so that there's still some progress being made or achieved in that fourth week. Like if you drop your volume, but actually increase your intensity a little bit, and it's just kind of a more extreme linear progress, which is kind of what I do. Like I'll drop a set off of everything. And that's, you know, a lot of different exercises. It's a big reduction in volume. I go to about 2/3 my normal volume, right? On average. But actually try to hit some PRs when they're there or just push a little heavier load. That becomes almost like that wasn't a fourth week deload. There's probably not a hypertrophic stimulus that's very robust, but there's definitely a neuromuscular strength stimulus there, which then gets a deload the next week when I'm doing higher reps, you know, lower intensity. So they work in concert, and I'm making the best of a suboptimal situation if we were just focusing on the realm of hypertrophy. So anyway, with someone who's a pure bodybuilder or a pure strength athlete goal, I would say that's the most frequent you'd want to deload. And then you should be feeling it for those 3 weeks leading up to it. That should be a hard training mesocycle to where you need that recovery every fourth week. But in general, I would say every 6 to 12 weeks is where you would see that a microcycle deload be needed or be beneficial. Any more frequent than that, and it may not be the most well-constructed program. And then in certain cases, an every fourth week setup is not unreasonable at all. Like if you're in the middle of your contest prep, I think that's a very decent rule of thumb. Always deload after each mesocycle, just because you're going to need it sometimes and you're always a little bit under recovered because you're dieting and getting leaner, low energy availability and all that. So, like the book, the way I set it up is there's an automatic deload after you've taken 3 mesocycles of that one. Just as like, you know what, I know you're not scoring high enough on this thing, but just in case, you know, because the relative reward of 1 week is so small, but the relative cost of overdoing it is so high. I think, you know, if you want to know some of the things that relate to injury and relate to illness, both of which cause more decrement in performance than simply not being optimal, the things that they relate to the most is an imbalance between acute changes in volume and where you were. So there's some data to suggest that in multi different athletes, if you increase volume by, say, more than 20% in a given microcycle, you're exposing yourself to a greater risk of immune suppression or injury. And if you look at some of the data in very high level athletes, there's relationships between doing a lot of volume and being injured and sick. And that then has a relationship and a knock-on effect on performance. And there was a paper that I reviewed in Mass where they looked at an Olympic cycle, and they found that the athletes who had to take more time off due to injury or more time off due to illness were less likely to get a medal. So I think, and that's a really interesting thing, because that's looking at a 4-year cycle. You know, we're really kind of looking at it, backing up and getting a bird's eye view. It's difficult to maintain that mentality when you're thinking about just the next 4 weeks or I'm following X program. So it does pay if you are someone, when you self-assess, that you tend to overdo it, you tend to really get after it, you love to go to failure or push hard in the gym, to probably land on the side of being a little more conservative than you would be naturally, because that's probably closer to an objective kind of midline, more optimal approach for balancing recovery and stimulus.
Yeah, for sure. And in that case, when you push it really hard, maybe like proactively increasing volume from mesocycle to mesocycle, you end up at a point where you're not in the position to push any further. And in that case, programming like a lower volume phase, which maybe extends the duration of a deload, might be beneficial. You haven't touched on maintenance phases or primer phases, as Steve Hall would call them, or promotes at Revive Stronger. What's your opinion on that? What might be potential benefits of those?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a time and a place where you would take an approach where you're just kind of getting back into things, you know, and you're looking at taking a more maintenance approach. Some of the times I really like to do that are after a contest prep season. So you have just been in a status of probably REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sport, very low energy availability, and there's going to be a multi-month period of recovery before you're, if you were to get a full hormone panel done, you were back up to an optimal place of building muscle. You know, testosterone's back up, free testosterone's back up. You're not having a heart rate that's like 25, you know, at rest. And I think a lot of people, their first thought is, awesome, I'm gaining weight, I'm going into a large surplus, I'm recovering post-show, I should also increase volume. But what they're forgetting is that they were basically hemorrhaging muscle in the last phase of that prep. No matter what they did, you could set up your training as best as you could, and you're probably still losing a little bit of muscle mass if you're a natural athlete. And it's only going to get better from there. You don't need to pile on more volume. Just let whatever you were doing in the gym work. And as calories come up and as body fat comes up and as you're correcting that low energy availability status, things are going to get better. So I essentially ask someone to keep their training moderate as their food comes up. And this acts as a recovery phase. You know, at the end of a contest prep, your volume and your total stress and your ability to put forth effort is going to look like a deload in the off season. And you're just going to start to feel better immediately. You're going to start sleeping well, but it's still not great. Like, there's a funny thing that happens when you exit a prep is that, like, every 4 weeks you think, oh, this is what normal is like. And then 4 weeks goes by again, you go, oh, no, this is what normal feels like. And you just forget how much trauma your body incurred. And you can imagine that, you know, having your testosterone, there's one case study where the baseline testosterone levels dropped to 25% in this pro-natural bodybuilder and then came back up at the three-month mark back up to 100%. So over this three-month period, when you're going from like below normal to low normal to moderate but low for you to normal, man, like that's small variations in testosterone probably don't make a big difference. But when you're going from like 250 to 1,000 over a three-month period, that's probably going to have a much larger impact on things. And you can just chill with your volume. So I like to see that kind of resensitization maintenance phase where training should be relatively easy but enjoyable. And your total volume should be quite low until you've quote unquote recovered from your prep. And I've actually seen trying to do the opposite cause problems. You know, people get injured in the post-show period, which is unfortunate, you know, because they think they're recovered more than they really are. And they're motivated because they just got off stage. They just, you know, didn't place as high as they did. Or maybe they got a pro card. Now they got to, oh, I got to compete against the pros. So their motivational status and their physical recovery isn't matched, but they can rationalize doing a lot because they're eating more. But it takes some time. There's a lag period. So that's one time. Another phase that I really like is any time after you've gone through a purposeful peak. So this is more for strength athletes. So you've just peaked for USAPL Nationals or European Championships or any competition, even a regional level one, and you've got that 8-week period where at the end of it, you need a taper. Or you would rather, I should say, you'd benefit from a taper. You'd perform better. The fact that you benefited from a taper, that you could perform better and noticeably when we pulled out fatigue, means that you were by definition overreaching, which means that by definition, you're under recovered. And then the stress of the day and heavy loading, all that, typically you need a period of kind of like rebuilding and resensitization, all that good stuff. There's also typically, not always that happens, is that your volume comes down enough that you actually get a little bit deconditioned, even though you're peaked for maximal force production, your strength endurance and your work capacity is a little lower. So it makes a lot of sense to have an easy mesocycle post-competition where you're building your volume tolerance back up and you're just slowly letting your loads creep back up. What I'll often do with some of my strength athletes, like for example, you know, Bryce Lewis will get a sheet that says, you know, after the meet, he'll be like, you know, do whatever the hell you want for a week. Uh-huh. Just at least train twice, you know, yeah. And you don't even have to do the big three. It can be anything. And then we reintroduce things. We have more variety. It depends on the competition schedule, of course, but we ease back into the training so that we can allow the motivation to rebuild, we can allow any aches and pains to dissipate, and we can get him to the point where he can handle the volume to produce the progress because you were peaking, but not necessarily stimulating progress through the utility of volume at the end of a peaking cycle.
Yeah. I think you mentioned some really good points. One of them was lower volume phases could have a resensitization effect. However, the research is not completely sold on that yet, especially on regarding the resensitization of muscle fibers. Regarding muscle damage, I think it's pretty obvious because when you're coming out of a deload, you're much more prone to experience soreness, and then the repeated bout effect kicks in and takes care of that. But Chris Beardsley wrote in an article that we should not confuse the tendency of a muscle fiber to be damaged with its ability to increase in size. And what are your thoughts on that, Eric?
Yeah, I don't think we fully understand that relationship. And a lot of the biochemical pathways for muscle regeneration are shared with the pathways for muscle hypertrophy, but it does not mean they're the same. While we've gotten much better at measuring tissue growth, muscle growth specifically, there is still some overlapping noise in our measurements. So there's a study by DeMoss that came out, I think 2016, 2017, where they found that there was no correlation between the initial muscle protein synthesis response in novices doing a new lift. So this is even more than a deload. So this is something that, like, the first time you ever trained. So a lot of muscle damage, right? Between the initial MPS markers and actual changes in hypertrophy. However, after that initial phase, after the first couple weeks, then there was a stronger relationship between MPS and a very strong relationship between MPS and actual hypertrophy, which shows that the body regenerating muscle damage and creating and going through structural repair, as far as an MPS marker goes, it looks the same, you know? So we can't effectively measure that very well. And I think that inability to measure that and the overlapping biochemical signals the inability for us to separate damage from stimulus, because overload produces both, makes it very difficult for us to tease out the two. But it doesn't fully make sense for them to be completely overlapping and to be the same. Obviously, if you stab yourself in the arm, you won't wake up with huge biceps the next day. Yeah. In fact, we do have some data showing that if you do a whole bunch of muscle damage, not only can you not produce a whole lot of force, but it can actually inhibit muscle growth or create muscle loss. But this might be happening at the same time as you gaining glycogen and gaining size. So it's a very messy thing. Some of the work by Cody Hahn that has come out showing that different type of training produces different types of hypertrophy within the muscle. It's a little more complex than just MPS and MPB. There is sarcoplasmic hypertrophy. How relevant it is, I'm not sure. There is gains in basically all the things that allow us to fuel a lot of contractions and produce work versus the actual myofibular. And then there's hypertrophy. And then there's also changes that can occur for synthesizing proteins for the structure in a muscle. The interconnections, but like, so focal adhesions, we have costimeres, there's the titin molecule, there is fascia, there is the extracellular, intracellular matrix of muscles. It's a pretty complex tissue. And all of those components respond to some degree, and we don't know really how well, differently to different stimuli. So what that all comes down to is that damage can occur to a lot of different tissues. Whether it's fully biochemical or actual structural, we're still teasing out. And the relationship between hypertrophy and damage is certainly unclear. Mm-hmm. And then one's perception, and then how do we measure that, right? So if we're not in a lab, you're pretty much measuring two things: performance. Typically, a damaged muscle is not going to produce as much force. And typically, a damaged muscle, you experience some degree of delayed onset muscle soreness. But the pain experience is very different between individuals. It's probably quite similar within individuals. So your level of soreness may or may not be correlated to the appropriate amount of volume for you. It's just correlated to lesser or more soreness for you. And we know that if you manipulate certain variables, that can go away. So there's actually research where people have increased their frequency, maintained their volume, grown the same amount or more, but delayed onset muscle soreness went down. So we can see that if you start to manipulate frequency, and like you said, the repeated bout effect has an effect on damage, but not necessarily hypertrophy. So now you have to question if you make large excursions in things that would affect the repeated bout effect. Now you've taken away any ability, in my opinion, to use muscle damage as a muscle soreness as a reliable marker of what have you done? Is this an appropriate amount of volume or not? I could see in a fixed kind of moderate frequency approach, maybe muscle soreness within individual, if you kind of use it compared to where you were, giving some indication of whether more overload or less overload has occurred. But you have to keep it in a pretty fixed thing. If you change your frequency, if you change your exercises, those things start to really throw that metric out to being less reliable.
Mm-hmm. So you think resensitization is not like the main reason why you would do a low volume phase?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't address that part of your question. I'm glad you brought me back to it. So it's an interesting question. You know, there is like a lot of people will postulate about anabolic resistance or needing to resensitize things or doing low volume phases or no training to then increase your hypertrophy later. But that's never really panned out in the research. Like if you look at folks who've taken time off and then come back, they will make rapid gains to get back to their old slope of progress, and then they'll make progress at that same rate. That probably speaks to some things related to, you know, the maintenance of myonuclei and maintenance of neuromuscular patterns, et cetera. And, you know, the whole muscle memory phenomenon. But I don't think we have any data to suggest that going through cyclical phases of a lower stimulus potentiates a greater stimulus for the specific goal of hypertrophy. It may indeed when you have multiple performance domains, but for hypertrophy, we don't have any data that gives me a lot of confidence in that. However, I do think that it makes sense to go through those periods of lower volume training or just easy training subjectively experienced for all the reasons I mentioned before, because of the interactions of a diet and a contest prep, because of peaking for a strength competition, or for manipulations of nutrition to change your body composition as they relate to your goals. But it's largely just due to the imbalance between stress and stimulus due to other factors changing. Or perhaps because you did a poor job of instituting more micro adjustments of deloads. Like if you skipped the four occasions where a deload probably would have been beneficial, yeah, now you've accumulated enough fatigue that you might need a full month off rather than just one of those weeks. But that's not because it's optimal. It's because that's what we're left with due to the way you were training, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's more of a logistical reality. Both Dan John and my good friend Chip Conrad have discussed how we need to view peaking with a relative level of respect and a relative level of caution. And the analogy they use that after every peak is a cliff. You know, after someone peaks for a powerlifting meet, they're typically nursing some things that are almost injuries, if not actual full-blown injuries. They're really burnt out. Their joints hurt. They probably had immune suppression. They were pushing the edges of volume of what they could do earlier in the cycle and then recovering just in time to push the edges of load on their body. And they're demotivated and they just had a huge emotional release of peaking for this big thing they've been focused on. So both psychologically and physiologically, they're in a place where while they were at peak performance, they're also very fatigued and in a position where they're open to injury. And you will typically see a drop in performance, minor or major, after a competition. And I think a good way to look at your overall performance when you're on one of those quote-unquote park bench kind of maintenance, not maintenance, but non-peaking phases of progress is that that's like your baseline walk-around level of performance. And that's great. And that should go up over a career. And that kind of acts as a trampoline to get to where could I peak to for a competition. So in general, you want to be pushing up that kind of foundation and then thinking, where can my trampoline then take me to? But recognizing that trying to land after you jump on that trampoline, if you're not paying attention, you could fall on the edge, break your ankle. You know, all the videos that we see on YouTube of kids not paying attention to landing on trampoline could be you. And it's a funny analogy, but I think it's a very apt one. Like I said, I can't tell you how many times you strangely see someone get hurt, sick, or demotivated after the season is over in bodybuilding, because now that goal is no longer there, but they're still in a fragile state, even though they're gaining body fat and increasing calories. And you'll also see people, they'll compete in worlds and they'll need to take a year off. Like, for example, Bryce Lewis, we were redlining it for a while. And one of the best decisions he made, and what pushed him up over a 900 kilo total in the 105s at last USAPL Nationals, was he competed at Worlds in 2018 and then took a competition cycle off. We were able to nurse injuries, get him back into a good motivated state, shore up a lot of his habits, regain confidence, and then really start to have a lot of runway to build up that foundation before we try to peak again. Because if you're constantly peaking, you might get really, really good at the peaking process. You know how to hit peak height from that trampoline, but the trampoline is staying in the same spot, you know? But if you can elevate the foundation below it, then you can get to new heights. But you don't get the opportunity to do that if you're constantly going through the process of peaking and recovering from those peaks.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much for that answer. I think you mentioned some really great analogies, and I'm currently in my last hypercaloric mesocycle before I will start my extended cut next year, and I'm really pushing it really hard, and I might just take a couple of weeks of maintenance afterwards just to clear the board and get ready for my extended cut, which might result in a contest prep later down the year. But I think you brought up a lot of great informations today for our listeners. I think they will all appreciate it, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time today, Eric, to come on here and talk about topics we love.
My absolute pleasure. I appreciate the questions. I think they provided a lot of value.
Awesome. Hey, that's great to hear. And where can people find you? You already mentioned Mass, I'm a lifetime subscriber since Black Friday, and I can only recommend your research review to anybody who is interested in getting the best information about strength and nutrition.
Thank you, Luis. I appreciate that. So basically you have to decide what level of nerd are you when you engage with my content. So the first place to go is 3dmusclejourney.com. That's the number 3, the letter D, then musclejourney.com. From there, you can find links to the 3DMJ Vault, which I would say is like the lowest nerd level. And that's designed for people who want to become students of the sport. We have stuff on how to perform exercises better, how to deal with the psychological questions you may have, and the experiences of going through recovery, fat loss, hypertrophy through our case study Q&As. And we have, a posing guide for competitors and also coaches. The next level of nerd is someone who wants to understand how to program for themselves or their clients and understand all the fundamental principles, both nutritionally and training-wise, and that's the Muscle and Strength Pyramids. You can also find a link at 3dmusclejourney.com to those, my books, along with my co-authors Andrea Valdez and Andy Morgan. And then finally is the peak nerd level, which you're a lifetime subscriber to, and that's monthly applications in strength sport. And that's a monthly research review of all the relevant research that we could find for strength and physique sport. And you can definitely check that out as well. For those who are living that life as lifters and they are finding meaning through it, and it's something that is a huge part of their identity, I would check out my podcast with my co-host Omar Isif, Iron Culture. And that's basically something we put out every Monday, where we talk to people in the community about science, culture, and history of lifting. So 3dmusclejourney.com, Iron Culture on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube. And then finally, you can follow me at Helms3DMJ on Instagram to kind of keep up with my day-to-day.
Perfect. I will link all the stuff in the show notes. And we have a Hypertrophy Cast playlist on Spotify. It's basically a playlist where we put put tracks on after every episode, which puts you in a good zone to train really hard, maybe at a 9 RPE on back squats. So do you have a track which you like to listen to on those hard sets?
Yeah, man. So I have a couple Spotify playlists. I have 3.
Okay.
So one is my funk playlist, and then one is my underground hip hop playlist, and then one is my 80s rock ballads. And it depends on the mood I'm in, they can all work, but I'll give you an example from each one. So one would be from the 80s rock ballads, Rock You Like a Hurricane. Fantastic.
Okay.
From the underground hip hop, I would say Dead Prez Hip Hop is a fantastic song, has a great bass line, classic bass line. Used to be on the old Chappelle show when he was running that. And then finally, from my funk playlist, I would say that Brick House is a classic that always makes you want to move. And that's a good song if you just want to really enjoy your training. Maybe you have a lot of volume instead of a 9 RPE on squats, but it keeps you moving and motivated to do a lot of work.
Yeah, really cool. We will definitely put all of these three in the playlist. So, yeah, you can check out what Eric Helms listens to when he's working out. And I'm going to put Time of Your Life from Tyrone and Physica. It's a hard style track. Do you listen to that on occasion?
Hey, if it's on, I'm down. And if it's something you can move to or not, or bob your head, I'll listen to it. But typically, my gym training is in those three domains of either 80s rock ballads when I'm feeling like I need the Eye of the Tiger to get after or the underground hip hop or a funk if I'm feeling like I need to have a little dance party in the gym.
Yeah, that's cool. And you used to do rap, right? Or hip hop?
Yeah, in my mid to late teens, early 20s, I was a break dancer, specifically pop locking, which I've incorporated a little bit into bodybuilding now as an adult. And then there was a period where I was also emceeing. So I would do like stand up. That sounds wrong. So I would do like spoken word poetry, rap battles, and recorded some music for a while. Yeah.
That's really cool. I just recently started freestyling with friends, you know.
That's awesome.
When we meet up, we just pick a random beat and then we just freestyle. Everyone has like a part and it's like really fun. So if we meet up next year at a seminar, I will definitely challenge you to a rap battle.
Hey, we'll slip into the cipher and I'll be impressed if you can do it in English. But I will say that German underground hip hop sounds cool because the language sounds very hard. So it has kind of that hardcore feel to it. And it's interesting to hear rhymes in German. You can hear the multisyllabic rhyme schemes. There's a lot of very technically skilled German rappers that I've listened to. I don't know who they are or what they're saying, but you can follow the patterns. Like, oh, they just rhyme four syllables. So, yeah, awesome. I'm down.
Nice, man. I'm looking forward to it. Okay, Eric, thanks so much again for coming on. Thank you guys for listening. If you like the episode, of course, leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts, YouTube. Follow us at Spotify. And see you next Sunday. Eric, have a great Christmas Eve tomorrow. And see you soon.
You too, man. Happy holidays. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.